just horrible. Well, I assume you're in no danger of fire right at the moment. You'll at least be able to get through the show, right?
I will try. However, I'm very excited, and I've got the fire to introduce you to our guest today, who is Dr. Fred Cohen. And Fred has just been one of the most stellar visionary in our industry. I mean, he started with, you know, helping define the term computer virus, has been helping an enormous amount of corporations around the world, as well as technology experts, to learn how to have a good defense mechanism. He then went on for 20 years and has been working in information assurance, information protection, has been winning award for integrity protection. He most in the latest years, have been working in digital forensics, and because it is it's a new area where a lot of people have questions. How do we go about doing good forensics analysis? I think that it is absolutely stellar that we have someone of the caliber of Fred Cohen to come and help us understand that particular segment. Obviously, Fred has been delivering a lot of courses. If anybody goes to his website, www.owl.net, you can find numerous tools that are outstanding. And given that right now he's putting a program together with the California Science Institute, I'm really excited about having him as a guest and talking about the trends in digital forensics and the challenges that corporations are going through, and how to meet the legal requirements that are out there right now and for the future.
Fred, welcome to the program. That is quite a billing. Is it all true?
Well, boy, if I was that good, I'd probably be wealthy.
Well, I assumed that you were, but, you know, now that you've raised the question, I'm not so sure.
Oh, I'll defend Fred any time. Someone that has work at Sandia, someone that is, you know, in so many organizations, has been working with the Burton Group, SAIC, certainly knows what he's talking about, and he's published over 200 articles on the topic. You just need to go to his pages and see his blog, and you'll see a lot of great topics on cloud computing to numerous other topics that are very current right now.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at your website right now, Fred. It's ALL.net for anyone who might have missed it. Anik did make a reference to it, ALL.net. And you certainly have been around for a while, and I think the word celebrity and expert is not too much of a stretch for you, because you do have a lot of topics you cover. Tell us a little bit about your business model and your clients before we launch into this discussion on digital forensics.
Sure. Well, I actually do two things, right? I'm the CEO of Fred Cohen & Associates, which is my small consulting firm, and I'm the president of California Sciences Institute, which is this new educational institution, a nonprofit that we're starting up. So my business focuses on two things. We do enterprise information protection, architecture, and consulting for large enterprises, and we do that through other companies. So we don't have any marketing, which is a sort of an unusual thing. So we've been very successful at working with others to help serve their customers sort of in a back-end sort of way. And then the other area we work is in digital forensics, where we do work towards testimony in court for high-valued cases. So, you know, it's quite an expensive endeavor to do a very good job of digital forensics on a complex case. For example, there's a case I'm working on right now that involves something like 100,000 records that are purported to be electronic mail. So when you're trying to do an analysis of 100,000 things and you have 30 days to produce your report, you can imagine it's a fairly intensive sort of effort.
When you get involved in that kind of an endeavor and you're doing your analysis, obviously you're looking for something. What typically are you looking for?
Well, so there's a general lack of a scientific theory in digital forensics and a scientific base. So what we've been focusing on lately is trying to build that up so that we'll have a strong scientific basis for the conclusions that we draw and the statements that we make. So the best theory that we have right now and the best scientific approach that we have right now is based on understanding consistencies and inconsistencies. So there are two kinds of consistency. One of them is called internal consistency, and that's just the consistency of the records with themselves. So, for example, if you have something that looks like it's supposed to be a Word document, but within it, it contains things that just don't appear in Word documents. They can't exist there. That would be an internal consistency. And then there's external consistency and inconsistency that has to do with the consistency of the digital traces with the other information relating to the case. So if somebody claims that, you know, on Tuesday, June 3rd, they were in Hollywood, and there's computer-related records that show traces that indicate that they weren't in Hollywood, then that would be an inconsistency between the traces from the computer and the other information provided by the actors in the case. So you try to look for these consistencies and inconsistencies and use those to drive information about what's real and what's not real about what took place.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating stuff, because that suggests to me that somebody is giving you a roster of consistencies and inconsistencies that they are interested in. In other words, you have to know that somebody is allegedly saying, I was in Hollywood, and we want to validate or not that representation. When we come back, we're going to explore this a little bit further with Fred and get some perspectives from Anik as well. So stay with us. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. If you're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com, we want to remind everybody we will be back again at 4 o'clock today to talk a little bit about cloud computing with our friends at Unisys Corporation, one of our sponsors. And so we want everybody to be able to take advantage of that show. We've got three or four key guests who are going to participate in that program as part of the government for Center for Innovation and Government initiative that is being sponsored by Unisys. So write that one down. That's one where you might want to call in or listen live to the program, take a few notes, and get some ideas about cloud computing and how the federal government is reacting to that whole initiative. The folks at Unisys do a very nice job of cluing us in on some of those initiatives and trends. So take advantage of it. 4 o'clock Eastern later today. I've got on the line with me the very talented Anik Turjan, our contact at Crossroads. We appreciate Crossroads' sponsorship of this program. And I also have on the line with me the Fred Cohen, Dr. Fred Cohen. We've been talking a little bit about digital forensics. I want to ask a little bit more about the agenda that you use to analyze this data. But I thought that during the break, before I do that, Anik did raise a very good question about court orders. Why don't you ask your question, Anik, and then we'll go from there.
Well, Fred, I think a lot of corporations, or CISOs, when we get a court order in for a corporation and we're being told, oh, you've got to provide all this data and within a certain period of time, we panic because basically we have such large buckets of data and they keep on increasing all the time. It's extremely hard to know what to do when we get a court order. And I wanted your recommendation, perhaps as per how to prepare in advance and what we should do in corporations to be really managing our data properly.
Right. So most CISOs these days for large enterprises have had this experience more than once.
Yeah.
So they already have some reasonable internal preparation. Generally speaking, you need to be prepared for legal holds by going through a data retention and disposition process. And that process is sort of well-defined. There's ISO standards surrounding this. There's also something called the Sedona Conference that discusses the legal issues related to this. And so typically in a large enterprise where they've experienced this before, they will have started to build out this policy and the procedures and the standards to carry out these retention and disposition processes. So the first step is always that the request comes into the chief counsel's office, and the chief counsel puts a hold from destruction on all of the relevant data. So the big problem is, how do you figure out what's the relevant data? And it's a big problem because if you're in a global enterprise and you have hundreds of terabytes a month that you're generating in data, and somebody says, I want everything involving Joe Smith who interacted with your company 2.5 years ago, it's going to be a big problem to figure out what everything is. So that's the big problem, is sort of sifting through and sorting through all the data that you have. So if you're not well prepared for it, it's a big, hairy, complicated problem. But one way or the other, you're going to be engaging your corporate counsel and likely an outside counsel for anything that's involving a lawsuit that you're a party to.
Now, let me ask a related question, because I want to get a perspective. I know you're not a practicing attorney, but you're involved in all of this, and you're working with these lawyers. And so you'll probably have a perspective on this. Let's see. You know, the judge wants to issue this order. You know, one side is, and usually when a judge issues an order like this, it's because one side is complaining about the fact that the other side is not being responsive in discovery, or, you know, they suspect that the other side's got data that the other side maybe is trying to suggest they don't have. And so they bring this motion in front of the judge, and the judge hears the arguments on both sides, and then the judge says, okay, well, I'm going to grant the motion. And the motion that the judge grants is very seldom the motion that is being petitioned for exactly. So the judge turns to the lawyers sometimes, as happens often, and he says to, okay, I'm going to grant the motion, and counselor, why don't you draft it? Now, what I'm getting at here is, how smart are the lawyers in the drafting of these motions with respect to the data? For example, let's assume I'm representing the defendant. The motion is against the defendant because allegedly the defendant is not being responsive. And so I get a chance to, influence this motion in terms of its wording and the data to be selected and so on and so forth. What is your perspective, Fred, about how smart the lawyers are at the time the motion is being drafted, in including or leaving out portions of data that they recognize are a bit of an issue for the company? You see what I'm driving at? Have we gotten to that level of sophistication yet?
So, generally speaking, I deal with a variety of different attorneys that have different knowledge. Now, most attorneys that I deal with are former English majors. They don't know a great deal about computers, but they know about the law.
Yeah.
So what they need is an expert that understands the technical issues and that they can communicate with about the legal issues so that that person can help them draft the proper request. Now, people that have been in law enforcement, they have standard templates for the list of things that they ask for. And depending on the particulars of the organization you're dealing with, there are various specifics. But generally speaking, you need to understand the business processes that underlie how the information gets generated
yeah.
in order to ask the right question.
Yeah, yeah. I would think that there is a huge issue there, that there's a big void, and that the bar and its members have not really, quote-unquote, caught up yet.
Yeah, well, I think the issue here is that expert witnesses have historically been viewed as somebody that comes in and looks at data after the fact. And if you wait too long in the legal process to get the expert involved, or if you don't have an expert that understands enough about the legal process, then you're basically going to get screwed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would assume that happens a lot.
There's the story of the, I guess it's the lions and the guys in the forest or something, and one guy says, I'm going to run, and the other guy says, you can't outrun a lion, and the first guy says, I don't have to outrun the lion, I just have to outrun you. So it's a competitive environment.
Yeah, I see the point. That's a very good story. I might steal that one. Yeah.
Actually, along in a different tangent, but it's still along the same line. Yesterday, Freddie mentioned that 80% of incidents or systems, when incidents happen on systems, it's because they're typically or on data, it's because they are not part of the inventory. Is there
yeah.
better inventory management tips that you have for corporations so they can plan in advance? And also, I have a question related to data classification. A lot of corporations think, how to do about doing data classification, about the creation of the data, but how do you manage it throughout its life cycle properly?
Yeah, so there have been studies recently that have been widely published that show that in investigations of detected break-ins where content was stolen or disrupted in some other way, that in 80% of those cases, the organization who was affected was unaware of either the systems or the content. So that belies a lack of inventory. In other words, they do have protection programs in place. Those protection programs do work. The problem is that they don't know that they have the stuff they're supposed to be protecting. So there's an obvious solution to that, and that's that ancient solution of having an inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not very good at having inventories of information because we don't have a good way of keeping track of it, and because there are different ways to track it for different purposes, right? So there's things like the sunk cost in building up the information. There's the replacement cost and other cost factors. Then there's issues of if you declare it a capital asset, it might be subject to taxes. So there's all those issues that come into play. But the biggest problem is if you're in a large enterprise, you might have acquired, you know, tens of companies over the last couple of years. And, you know, so you have to then bring each of those 10 companies into the fold and all of the data they have from all around the world into your repositories. So the sheer volume and complexity of it might be so high that you just can't keep track of it all.
Yeah. I see that especially at large enterprises where customers are beyond being able to do an inventory, especially when they are exposed or doing business in several countries.
Yeah, well, also just keeping track of all the things you do is pretty complicated. If you have tens of thousands of employees interacting with other companies and you're getting different data through all these employees from other companies, if you really tried to track it all, you would reduce your efficiency as a business significantly. So you sort of have to make a decision about what's important and how important and what you're going to do automatically and what you're going to do manually and so forth.
When we come back, we're going to get some more thoughts from Fred on these key questions like how you value the data. We're going to ask him to tell us a little bit more about the California Sciences Institute and other key issues. We're going to gather together more pearls of wisdom from our guest when we come back. Stay with us, mytechnologylawyer.com. Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. This is our Crossroads-sponsored program. I got to tell you, Anik Turjan, my very talented co-host, has made all kinds of arrangements with all kinds of people to have them guest on the show between now and the end of the year. We are planning that fall schedule. If you'd like to be on the program, you can contact Anik or you can contact me and let her know that you'd like to be on the show. It doesn't cost anything to be on the show, and we're always interested in new content, new ideas, different business models, agendas, your thoughts on some of the burning issues that are affecting the technology industry, security being right at the top of the list, but there are also many others. And we'd love to hear from you, so send us an email at radio@mytechnologylawyer.com, or Anik, why don't you give your email address where they can send a request to you?
It's aturgon, T-U-R-G-O-N, @crossroads.com.
Okay, take advantage of it. We'd love to hear from you. We've got on the line with us Fred Cohen, celebrity guest. We met Fred in Menlo Park as part of the Security Innovation Network. We're going to get Fred to tell us a little bit about his experience with the Security Innovation Network. But before we do this, I think Anik has another question for Fred.
Fred, you told me that I can ask tough questions. Well, I read the press, and they are telling the industry that, you know, digital forensics are for the birds. It's a passe type of skills that a lot of what the verdicts have been rendered were on were delivered upon bad estimates and bad evaluations. What are the biggest problems in that industry, and what can we do to resolve those problems?
Well, as you're well aware, I'm a big advocate for education in this area. That's why we're starting an educational institution with master's and PhDs in digital forensics, because I believe that we need people with more expertise and with more clarity around the issues in order to do the job right. And the biggest reason is that the courts are now making decisions that are setting precedents. And these precedents, if they're bad precedents, will affect everybody for a long time to come.
How are we going to go and revert those precedents?
Well, that's an awful tough thing to do. You need to have other judges overturning verdicts. You know, eventually stuff gets to the Supreme Court, and it takes a long time. I mean, it's not unusual for a case, after it's completed, to have another 3 to 5 years in the appeals process. So, and in the meanwhile, other cases are following those precedents, right? And the lawyers pick the precedents that are appropriate to the point they're trying to make and use those to try and get judgments in their favor. So it's the better precedents from higher courts have a bigger effect.
You know, this is a little bit discouraging because I got to tell you, one of the shows that series that we do is the My Technology Lawyer radio show Supreme Court series. And one of the things that we have learned in doing that show over the last couple of years is that the Supreme Court won't even grant certiorari to difficult patent cases. They only take really simple patent cases. The argument seems to be by the patent bar that they're afraid of these difficult, complicated patent cases because they don't have a good grip on the technology. Now, if that's the true case with the patent cases, I can imagine with some of the digital forensic data management issues, it might be quite some time before the Supreme Court really gets itself involved in some of those burning questions. So this makes it all the more important to try to get it right the first time.
I agree.
Yeah, that's a very difficult.
So I would like to hear more about this this university that you're putting together, what it is going to be, how different is it from the courses that we take at STANS and CSI and other places. And also I would want to, because I just got a question from a member of the audience that was sent to me, they wanted to hear a little more about your policy assistant. So three questions there.
Sure. Well, so the university is currently at calsci.org, calsci.org, and our programs are graduate only. We don't have an undergraduate program, and we have master's and Ph.D. programs, a master's in national security and a Ph.D. in national security. These are about the technical issues of national security, not about the geopolitical interactions. And then there's a master's in advanced investigation with a Ph.D. in digital forensics. Actually, we're the first Ph.D. in digital forensics in the country. There's no other school doing it at this point. So we're sort of sticking our noses out, if you will, and hopefully we won't get anything chopped off. Our program exists largely for people that are already working, right? So people come to classes for 8 weekends over the period of a year to get a master's degree, and it takes at least 3 years to get a Ph.D. in a similar program. And it's a fairly intensive graduate program. Now, the big difference between places like STANS and Computer Security Institute and what we do is they're largely oriented towards getting you what you need to know to do specific work functions for a specific period of time, 2 or 3 years. So you'll get on some tool and be trained, and there's some educational value there too, but their focus is on how to do things that help you right now. Education is about understanding that's going to last you a lifetime. So we're trying to bring about the next generation of researchers and people that are going to be able to understand at the deepest level what's going on and make, let's say, decisions about any technology that might arise. So there's a huge difference between the sort of thing that we're trying to do and the sort of thing that they're trying to do. And what they're doing has great value, right? I mean, don't get any misimpression. It's tremendous value to be able to go and take a course, learn how to use a tool effectively.
Yeah.
And so that's needed. But our focus is on the rest of your life and understanding the deeper issues. So that's that question. Now, policy assistant, that's a tool. So I have a whole bunch of tools. And these tools emerge from my consulting practice, right? So I've helped to build policies for lots of large enterprises. Another thing we've done is analyze policies. We had an instance where we had an institution that had 40 different sets of policies. We reconciled them all in a big matrix and found out, you know, there are policies that disagree with themselves internally. So one says do this, and the other one says don't do this. And then we find that sometimes there's a loop. One policy will say refer this other policy, and the other policy refers back to the first policy. So after you do that kind of analysis, then you need to build up policies by using elements of existing stuff, right? There's no reason to start from scratch on a password regarding passwords. A policy regarding passwords, for example. Well, there's plenty of policies out there. There's plenty of standards. So the policy analysis tool lets you look up what the other standards are doing in each of these policy areas and pull the things from those other policies, drop them in, and apply them where they're appropriate. So those are the kinds of tools that we build. Basically, what they do is they allow somebody that knows what they're doing to do it more quickly.
I got to ask this related question, and I don't know if we have time to get it before we go to the commercial break, but I'll get my question out, and then maybe you'll get a chance to think about it. And that is, I'm interested in your view about which industries are more mature in this area than others. In other words, I have the impression, for example, in some of the sectors of the federal government, they've gotten fairly sophisticated with some of these analyses, and that retailers also, in terms of commercial enterprise and financial institutions, are probably a little bit ahead of some of the consulting practices that are around. When we come back, we'll see if you concur with that and get some more pearls of wisdom on other industries and where they fit in this overall matrix of competency when it comes to the question of digital forensics. Stay with us. MyTechnologyLawyer.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. We're talking about digital forensics with our guest. Anik and I are talking about digital forensics with Fred Cohen, and he is educating us a bit on approaches and needs and where the industry is. I want to go back to my question, though, about your perspective on the level of maturity that's out there. Some industries are farther along than others. Give us your perspective on the spectrum.
So there are certainly some industries that are better historically, and today I find that they're better as well. The financial industries, for example, have been under regulation for many, many years. Plus, you know, the money isn't pieces of paper anymore, it's bits. So, you know, if they screw up, they can lose a lot of money right away. And they really care about money more than anything else, right, because that's their business. So they're very good at tracking certain things associated with money, transactions. You know, they have a lot of redundancy. They know how to look things up. They have regulations that are enormous and voluminous. So, for example, this relates to outsourcing and cloud computing, which is another area that Anik was interested in. What happens is in the financial industries, there are a lot of vertical organizations that do specific functions. And those specific functions, they do very well, and they track all the regulations and do all the paperwork. And it becomes incredibly expensive to do the same thing yourself. So those vertical organizations become a good place to outsource. But before a bank, for example, can outsource financial record keeping or analysis to somebody, that company has to meet all the regulations. So there's an enormous number of banking regulations, and there's lots of audits and other similar sorts of things that take place. So in that area of cloud computing and outsourcing, these private outsourcers are very, very good at doing everything a financial institution needs. So that's an area where you'd almost be crazy not to outsource certain functions to them unless you're very, very large. On the other hand, if you're in another industry like you're writing software, right, or you're manufacturing cars or something like that, there aren't the same number of vertical industries supporting information technologies in those areas. There aren't the same sorts of regulatory mandates in place. They haven't been in place for a very long time. So it's a much more difficult proposition to believe that they're going to follow every regulation for dealing with every issue that you're going to have across the world. So the companies, in this case, large enterprises, have more experience in doing that and more knowledge. So those are areas where you wouldn't want to outsource those sorts of functions. So there's a lot of movement towards cloud computing because of the economy of scale. And the economy of scale is good. You just have to be careful that you're not, you know, trading something that you need for something that you want.
In terms of cloud computing, and also I see some other trends like automated audits and automated policies and automated transfers of data and migration in general. How do you recommend that corporations maintain over time transfers and all kinds of activities related to data, especially now that a lot of data is being moved to outsourced environment with cloud computing? and be able to ensure the integrity of the data.
Yeah, so it's not just the integrity. There's also an availability issue, right?
Yes,
because
yes.
you give it to somebody else
Absolutely.
Doesn't mean you're not responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, and you may have a contract, but if you have a contract with a small company and they go out of business, you're still responsible for your big company information. There's also a bunch of stuff going on right now. There was a period of time when law enforcement, long ago, when they would do an investigation, would grab all the computers from a facility and therefore shut down the business. Now, then after there was some experience with that and large enterprises, you know, sort of had big bad things happen because of law enforcement grabbing all their computers for forensic purposes and shutting down the business, so law enforcement backed off of that and the networking between law enforcement and corporations increased. And this happened through things like these organizations that the U.S. Secret Service created for interacting with corporations and others in the community. Okay, so now, recently, this has reverted. There have been a couple of raids recently where federal agencies have taken all the computers from an internet service provider, which means all of the computers sitting in that data center belonging to other companies, all the backup tapes and everything else have been taken, and the courts have supported the retention of these things by law enforcement. And this has literally put businesses out of business. You know, so at this point, things are swinging the other way. So the key here is, whatever you're responsible for it whether it's outsourced or not. So you have to have proper controls, proper audits, proper management over it. You need to make sure that, you know, the data maintains its integrity, that it's available for your use. If it's leaked by some process, you're responsible for it regardless of who is holding it at the time. Right? You have to make sure that you can control who uses it and for what purposes, and that you can account for it. So you just have to, you know, there's a notion that somehow if I give the problem to somebody else, they can do it better, faster, and cheaper than I can. But it's not true. It's only true for cases where they have specialized expertise and they have economies of scale, and where the liability can be properly covered by what they have in terms of organizational liability and money, you know, resources, and these sorts of things.
Are you suggesting by your observation that the legal framework in this country is trending in such a way that cloud computing no longer becomes a viable alternative because of the liability exposure? You don't have control. You've got another party involved. It's just not worth the risk.
Well, so the private cloud computing is about distribution of computation. It's about being able to use parallelism to get more performance when you need it. And that you can do within an organization. Those are internal clouds. Those have always been viable and continue to be viable. There's outsourced clouds. Those are things that you do when there's a vertical where they have more expertise and economies of scale, and you have appropriate controls that you can put in place and redundancy. And then there's the public cloud. And the public cloud is the thing that's emerging right now, and it's useful for things that are commodities, so you can buy them in volume anywhere, and where there's no great import to the business. A good example, some of the California universities have outsourced their student email system to Google, Gmail. And basically what they're saying is they're not used for any record. The students have access to it. We don't have to worry about it. But we don't care what goes out there, and we're not going to record anything. We just don't care. But for internal mail, where you're making business records, making business decisions, tracking grades and so forth, you need to have control, so they can't outsource that. So that's an example where outsourcing to public clouds can function.
Yeah. Fascinating. When we come back, we're going to get Fred to spend a little bit of time talking about the Security Innovation Network, and we're going to have some closing thoughts from Anik. So you stay with us. MyTechnologyLawyer.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to MyTechnologyLawyer.com. This is your host, Scott Dron, and Anik Turjan. This is our Crossroads-sponsored program. If you'd like to participate on a future program and be a guest on the Crossroads show, you can send us an email. Send it to radio@MyTechnologyLawyer.com. We have all kinds of interesting topics on the program and guests. Our guest today is a particularly spectacular celebrity guest. Fred Cohen is with us. Check out his website, ALL.net. Lots of tools, lots of observations. You've got a, it looks like you're, you do an article about once a month, sometimes more frequently than that, on some of the key issues. Tell me a little bit about your, how you figure on what you write about. How do you settle on your topics?
I have a monthly analyst article, usually a page or two, and some of them I come up with over a long period of time, but mostly whatever seems to be interesting today, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, the July 1st article was about, there was a legal matter, it's now settled, in which a so-called expert on the other side claimed that the Internet travels faster than the speed of light. He didn't know he was claiming that. He was just making a claim that turned out to assert that the Internet runs faster than the speed of light. So I just thought that that'd be a really good example of the kind of thing that we need not to do.
Okay, well, it's very interesting. And you've got a number of them listed on the front page of your website there, so people can learn more. But I don't want to let the radio hour get away from us because on this one particular issue, I met you in Menlo Park as a result of an invitation and an introduction that Anik made for me to Robert Rodriguez, the Security Innovation Network. And I can't say I am continually impressed with Robert Rodriguez and all the great work that he's doing and the events that he is putting together. I know that you're part of that whole network. So tell me a little bit about how you got involved and the value you're getting out of it.
Well, so the Security Innovation Network is really an outstanding organization as organizations of that sort go. It's all about building a public-private partnership, and Robert has created a nonprofit organization to do this, and he gets funding from the private sector and the public sector basically to get them together. We hear talks from, you know, anybody from, I guess the last time we had the CEO of Heartland talking about, you know, what happened to Heartland payment system. And we have scientists talking about their latest research and recent results. And so there's a tremendous spectrum. We had the former head of the National Security Agency talking about, you know, what government's trying to do and where they're going to go and where they're going to stay away from. And so it's sort of fascinating to see how the state of the art in science and research gets pushed into use in government and industry. And the Security Innovation Network is about getting those people together with the idea that that's the way it's likely to move forward, you know, through individual action, through meeting and knowing and finding out about people and helping other people.
Yeah.
So it's a really good organization. Robert also used to be at the U.S. Secret Service. And so the U.S. Secret Service, that's the group that created the Electronic Crimes Task Force, starting with the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force that Bob Weaver started, that I was a member of years ago. And now, of course, their regional task force is following that model.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I'm continually impressed and by Robert and the depth of the organization, the quality of the programs. I've got to say that Robert did send me an email the other day, and I think I forwarded it on to you as well, Anik, and that is that the Security Innovation Network is partnering with the SC Magazine for the Security Innovators.